Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Story 1. I live in a town you've probably never heard of, a place wedged between endless fields and cracked county roads in southern Illinois. It's the kind of town that smells like burning leaves in the fall and rotting corn in the spring. I've worked as a motor vehicle collision analyst here for almost 12 years. I reconstruct how people die in car wrecks. It's not a job you plan to have as a kid. You just sort of end up there, if you've got a strong stomach and no better ideas. It was late October when it happened, right around that time when the wind starts to bite harder at night and you realize the long winter's not far off. I was at home, changing the oil in my truck, when the call came through. Fatality on Route 27, shallow S-curve just past the old mill. I wiped my hands on a rag and drove out without saying much to my wife, figuring it would be another late one. By the time I got there, the sheriff had already taped off the scene. Blue lights flashing across the fields, a single vehicle, a beat-up Toyota Corolla, was resting about 30 feet off the road, upside down in a ditch. I parked behind the ambulance that wasn't in any hurry to leave. When you work wrecks like this, you can tell if someone's alive before you even step out of the truck. The girl, early 20s, had been thrown clear during the roll. No seatbelt. Rookie mistake. Her body lay face down in the dirt, one arm twisted underneath her like a broken doll. When I got closer, I realized she was actually on her back. It was just that half her skull was missing. Her brain was everywhere, splattered along the roadway, matted into the grass, even chunks wedged in the cracked windshield. I've seen a lot, more than most ever should, but this one stopped me cold for a second. The fracture ran from her left eye socket clean across to the back of her head, splitting her almost neatly in two. You could see the hollow cavity inside where the brain had been. Her eyes were still open, staring at nothing. The whole scene stank of hot metal, ruptured fluids, and something else, that greasy, nauseating smell of blood baked by the sun. I shook it off, took photos, walked the debris field. I was fascinated in a way. The mechanics of death, how the physics of a single mistake tear a human body apart. After a few hours, once we'd bagged her up and the wrecker hauled off what was left of her car, I stood by my truck to fill out the preliminary report. My phone buzzed in my pocket. It was my wife. "Hey," she said, all cheerful. "You almost done?" "Almost." "Rough one," I muttered, glancing back at the bloodstained road. "Well, don't be too late," she said. "Remember? Pumpkin carving night with the kids. They're so excited." I didn't answer at first, just stood there staring at the smears drying black on the pavement. All I could think about was the way her brain had looked. Soft, crumbled, glistening. I swallowed hard. Promised I'd be home soon. Hung up. By the time I pulled into the driveway, the sun was long down. My boys were already at the table, grinning wide, their pumpkins lined up in front of them. My wife handed me a knife and kissed my cheek. "You okay?" she asked. "Fine," I lied. I sat down, staring at the pumpkin. Orange, round, solid. The flesh was tough when I drove the knife in, and the sound it made, a wet, fibrous rip, turned my stomach. I tried not to think about the scene from earlier. Tried to ignore how the texture under my hands felt wrong. Too close to the sensation of picking up the brain matter off the road. I managed to carve a crooked mouth before I had to excuse myself. Locked myself in the bathroom and sat on the edge of the tub, breathing hard. I didn't carve another pumpkin that year, or the year after. In fact, I haven't carved one since. Story 2. You spend enough nights around the dead, you start to convince yourself nothing's gonna faze you. That's what I thought anyway. My name's Tyler. I'm from a nowhere town called Greenville, Tennessee. Worked overnight body transport for a private funeral company back in 2019. It was supposed to be simple. Pick up, drop off, don't think too hard about it. Our boss had this stupid obsession with appearances. Wanted us to look like chauffeurs for corpses or something. Black suit, white shirt, tie, white gloves, the whole thing. Even made us drive these jet black Sprinter vans. No logos, no markings. Just looked like some government spook van you'd rather not ask questions about. I didn't care. The pay was good, and I liked working nights. No people, no traffic. One Thursday, about 2 in the morning, I get a call from dispatch. Lady had passed from breast cancer earlier that evening in Knoxville General. Family wanted her taken to a funeral home about 250 miles out near Asheville. I grab the paperwork, load her into the van, and head out. Everything's normal. After the first hour, I'm just in that mind-numbed state you get on the road. The world outside's pitch black, only my headlights cutting through it. It's one of those deep, dead nights when even the radio sounds like it's coming from the bottom of a well. No other cars, just me, the woman in the back. An endless highway. I wasn't scared. You learn quick the dead can't hurt you. It's the living you gotta watch out for. I had the heater cranked because it was cold as hell that night, and the vents kept making this soft tick-tick-tick noise. I'm cruising about 70 down the interstate when I hear something. Quiet at first. Thought it was the wind. Then plain as day, from the back of the van, I hear this low, shaky moaning. My chest locked up so hard I almost dropped the steering wheel. It didn't sound human. It didn't sound dead either. It was this broken, wet sound, like something trying to cry but forgetting how. I jerked the van so bad I nearly flipped it off the road. Tires screamed against the asphalt, gravel shooting up like bullets as I swerved onto the shoulder. I slammed the van into park and just sat there, heart punching my ribs. For a second, I convinced myself maybe something had shifted back there. Maybe the body rolled or the stretcher strap slipped. That's logical, right? That's sane. I turned the dome light on. My hands were shaking so bad the keys rattled. I sat there staring at the rearview mirror, trying to see if anything was moving in the back. Nothing. Just the long black bag zipped up tight on the stretcher. But then, as clear as if she were sitting in the passenger seat beside me, I hear it again. Longer this time, deeper, like someone sobbing with their mouth wired shut. I didn't move. I couldn't move. I just sat there, paralyzed, gripping the wheel so tight my fingers started going numb. The hair on my arms was standing straight up, and I swear to God, the inside of that van felt like it dropped 20 degrees in an instant. I'm not religious. I'm not even superstitious. But sitting there, I was absolutely sure of one thing. Whatever was making that noise was not natural. It wasn't mechanical. It wasn't air pressure. It was coming from her. I couldn't bring myself to get out. I just sat there breathing like a rabbit, trying to decide if I should call someone. What do you even say? Hey, boss, the corpse you sent me with is crying? Good luck keeping your job after that. I leaned forward just a little, like a dumbass, trying to listen closer. That's when the van rocked. Not like a little bump. I mean like someone inside stood up and shifted their weight, making the whole frame lurch to the left. I gasped so hard I hurt my throat. My mind just blanked. Every survival instinct I ever had screamed one thing. Do not open that back door. I grabbed the shifter, jammed it into drive, and floored it. Gravel and dust exploded behind me as I ripped back onto the highway without looking. I didn't care if another car hit me. I just had to get moving. Had to outrun whatever the hell was trying to, I don't even know what. Speak? Escape? The rest of that drive is a blur. I didn't turn the radio on, didn't look in the mirrors, didn't breathe unless I had to. Every second felt like something was creeping up the length of the van, clawing its way toward the front. When I finally pulled into the funeral home's back lot, I didn't even park right. Just slammed the brakes and jumped out like the van was on fire. The funeral director on duty came out, gave me this weird look, I must have been pale as a sheet. I handed him the paperwork without saying a word. Didn't even wait to watch them unload her. I got in my personal car and drove straight home. Called off sick for 3 days after that. Couldn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I heard that noise again. I never asked if anything strange happened at the funeral home. Didn't want to know. And I never worked another night shift after that. Story 3. I'm Evan, and I used to work at Fairhaven Mortuary, just outside of Boise, Idaho. I don't usually talk about this. People either don't believe you, or they believe you too much. And then you're stuck living it all over again, while they stare at you like you've got something crawling under your skin. It was late October when it happened. Cold enough that the floor tiles in the prep room had that sharp kind of chill that gets into your bones. I was working alone that night. Our lead embalmer, Rick, had taken the night off, and we were between shifts. Quiet night. Or at least it was supposed to be. We had a
live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
Viewing scheduled for a man named Walter Pratt. 60s, heart failure, standard case. His family wanted an open casket viewing. Just a couple of hours so the grandkids could say goodbye. Walter had no teeth, full dentures, but the family didn't want them in. Said he never liked wearing them, even when he was alive. Now, if you know anything about mortuary work, you know that a body's jaw doesn't stay shut naturally. Gravity works against you. We usually use something called a mouth former, a plastic device that holds everything together, keeps things looking peaceful. Rick had set Walter up earlier in the day, secured everything, dressed him, made him look good. I double-checked before the family came in. He looked fine. His mouth was shut, hands folded over his chest like a painting almost. The viewing started at 6. About a dozen family members, mostly quiet, some crying. I stayed out of the way like we're supposed to, posted at the back of the room. 30 minutes in, I noticed something strange. There was this low creaking noise, real soft. I thought maybe it was the cooling vents kicking on. I looked up at the casket. That's when I saw it. Walter's mouth started to open, slowly, like someone struggling to yawn underwater. It wasn't sudden, it was deliberate. His jaw unhinged further and further until it hung wide open. The angle was all wrong. It looked like he was trying to scream but couldn't. His tongue was stiff, swollen, poking out just slightly, and I swear to God, for half a second, it looked like it twitched. I moved fast. I told the family there was a minor issue and that they needed to step out for a moment. Most of them didn't even notice at first. The lighting was dim, and people were too caught up in their grief. I ushered them into the lobby, heart pounding so loud I could hear it in my ears. Back inside, I tried to fix it. I grabbed a small tube of mortuary-grade adhesive we kept on hand, basically super glue for emergencies like this. I pressed Walter's lips shut and held them, counting out 30 seconds. When I let go, they stayed closed for about 2 heartbeats. Then, without warning, his lips pulled apart again with a wet pop, wider this time, and his head lolled to the side like he was trying to look at me. His gums were black and shriveled inside, and that same awful twitch jerked his tongue again. "No," I said out loud, backing away. My hands were shaking so badly I dropped the glue. There was no way, no natural way, that could happen. Rigor mortis was long past. Walter should have been stiff, inert, nothing but dead weight. But he wasn't. It was like something inside him was moving. I panicked. I called over to Millstone Mortuary, two streets down. Gerald was their embalmer on call that night. I told him, "I need you here. Now emergency." I must have sounded crazed because he didn't even ask questions. He said he was on his way. While I waited, I didn't go near the casket. I just stood by the door and watched. And Walter, he didn't stop. His mouth kept twitching wider, stretching the corners of his lips until the skin around them began to crack. His neck muscles flexed and twisted. His hands, folded so neatly across his chest, started to tremble, the fingertips tapping against each other in these uneven, jerky spasms. It wasn't rhythmic, like nerve settling. It was erratic, intentional. The worst part? I could hear these faint, moist, clicking noises coming from his throat, like he was trying to force something out but didn't have the air or the lungs to do it. By the time Gerald showed up, I was practically hyperventilating. He didn't say a word when he saw Walter. Just grabbed his embalming kit, pulled out a heavy needle and thick black suture thread, and told me to hold the jaw steady. "Don't look at him," Gerald said while threading the needle through Walter's jaw, from under his chin and straight up through his gums into his palate. "Just hold him." I tried not to, but my eyes flickered to Walter's face once. Just once. His eyelids were trembling, like someone having a nightmare. After sewing the mouth shut tight, Gerald wiped the sweat from his forehead and said, "Burn that mouth former. Don't reuse it. Sometimes they bring something back with them." I stared at him, stunned. "What the hell are you talking about?" Gerald just packed up his kit without answering and left. Fast. The family came back in after we straightened everything out. None of them seemed to notice that the stitches inside Walter's mouth were now barely concealed. They said their goodbyes. The night ended like nothing had ever happened. Story 4. I never really planned on working with the dead. It just kind of happened. I live in a small town outside of Omaha, Nebraska. Quiet, nothing ever really going on. After high school, jobs were either fast food, factory, or, if you didn't mind it, the funeral home. I figured it'd be quiet work, respectful, and it was, most of the time. About a month in, I got stuck working Memorial Day weekend. Everyone else had plans, and honestly, I didn't mind picking up the extra hours. It was just me and the two transport guys who were basically in and out all day, picking up calls from the hospital, the nursing homes. The place was big, old, kind of a maze once you got past the viewing rooms. It was about 5:30 in the evening when it happened. I was sitting behind the counter in the front office, trying to stay awake, flipping through an old Reader's Digest someone left behind. I heard the back door slam, normal, transport guys dropping someone off. I figured they were doing their thing, and I'd check in with them in a few minutes. A couple minutes pass, and I realize I needed to ask them if the body had any special notes. You're supposed to log everything, jewelry, clothing, any medical devices, before anything else. I remember thinking, just go grab them real quick. So I got up, walked through the double doors leading to the back prep area. The lights were half dimmed, the way they always were when nobody was actively embalming. The room smelled like disinfectant and cold metal. I pushed the swinging door open with my shoulder, calling out, "Hey, you guys still here?" No answer. I stepped inside, expecting to see Mike or Darren messing around, maybe grabbing gear or paperwork. Instead, the body they had just dropped off, this old guy, thin, bony, maybe 70, was sitting upright on the gurney. I froze. For a solid second, I thought it was a joke, like they rigged him up or something, but his head turned toward me. Not fast, slow, like someone stiff trying to look over their shoulder. Our eyes met, and he smiled. It wasn't a twitch. It wasn't rigor mortis pulling at his face. It was a real smile, thin and tight, like he knew something I didn't. My knees buckled. I stumbled backwards so hard I slammed into the wall behind me. I felt this horrible cold pressure settle into my chest, like something heavy was sitting on me. I couldn't catch my breath. Couldn't move. He just kept smiling. I remember whimpering, not even able to scream, just this pathetic sound crawling out of my throat. I swear to God I could hear him breathing, wet, rattling little gasps that didn't match the way his chest wasn't even moving. I don't know how long I stood there. It could have been a second or a full minute, but somewhere in that frozen panic, the body just dropped, like a puppet with its strings cut. He flopped back against the gurney with a heavy thud, arms splaying out awkwardly at his sides. The sound snapped me out of it. I ran, full-on sprinted through the hallway, hit the door to the front office so hard I jammed my shoulder. I didn't even think about grabbing my stuff. I just bolted outside and sat on the curb, shaking so bad my teeth were chattering. Mike and Darren showed up about 15 minutes later from another call. When they saw me, white as a sheet and half hyperventilating, they thought I'd gotten mugged or something. I couldn't even explain it right away. When I finally stammered out what happened, they laughed at first, said sometimes corpses can twitch or sit up from gas buildup, that it's rare, but it happens. They tried to make it sound normal, but they didn't see the way he looked at me. They didn't hear that breathing. There's no way any natural process could explain that smile. I quit 2 days later. Never set foot in a funeral home again. Story 5. It wasn't like I grew up dreaming about working security at a hospital in Detroit, but bills don't pay themselves, and Henry Ford Medical Center was always hiring. I got the job 6 months after leaving the Army, and most nights were dead boring. No pun intended. Badge checks, door sweeps, the occasional drunk screaming in the ER. The morgue, though, that was another story. We were responsible for 10 to 80s, moving the bodies from the floors down to cold storage when transport wasn't available. Most guards hated those calls. I didn't mind at first. A body's just a body when you tell yourself that enough times. It was a Thursday night, middle of winter, freezing rain tapping against the concrete like fingernails. I was posted near the ICU when dispatch buzzed me. 10 to 80 from 3 South, pick up and drop to Morgue 1, they said, bored as hell. I grabbed a stretcher and rolled it up to the third floor. The nurses had already zipped the old man into a black body bag. They handed me the clipboard, signed it like they were checking out groceries, and went back to whatever soap opera was playing on the nurses' station TV. "Guess it's just you and me, pal," I muttered. I got him down the service elevator, no problem. Morgue was in the basement, 2 floors down, dark, colder than the rest of the hospital. Fluorescence buzzed overhead, one light near the cooler flickering, like it couldn't decide if it wanted to be alive or dead. The body fridge was this giant metal thing, with wide sliding doors. Inside were racks like oversized filing cabinets, each one with a tag. I pulled open an empty drawer, cranked the stretcher up to line it up, and unzipped the bag halfway to double-check the toe tag. Name, Harold Grayson. Age, 79. His face was a waxy yellow, mouth slightly open like he was about to say something and forgot how. His hands were rigid as branches, arms sticking out wide like he was frozen mid-convulsion. Stiff, unnatural. I needed to move his arms in so he could fit. I grabbed his right wrist, hard and cold like stone, and pushed it toward his side. It gave a little, but not much. I figured once I moved the left arm too, I could slide him in easier. "Sorry, Harold," I said, grunting as I pressed his other arm down. I held both his arms crossed over his chest for a second to make sure they stayed. Satisfied, I let go and turned to grab the transfer sheet. That's when it happened. Smack! I doubled over before my brain caught up. A pain shot straight into my groin, sharp, crushing, and I staggered back, almost tripping over the stretcher. "What the fuck?" I gasped, grabbing my knees, trying not to hurl. When I looked up, Harold's right arm was hanging off the stretcher, pointing straight at me. I froze. I swear to God, for a second, it was like his fingers twitched. Just a slight curl. Enough to send my heart into my throat. The morgue around me felt like it folded in, like the walls leaned closer. That flickering light overhead blinked out entirely, leaving just the dim glow from the hall. I could hear my own breathing, sharp and ragged. I didn't even realize I was backing up until my shoulder slammed into the fridge doors behind me. "No," I whispered. "No, no, no." The bag, the body, it shifted. Not a lot, just a slight shuffle, like something inside was adjusting itself. I stared, didn't move, couldn't. I told myself it was rigor mortis, air pockets, muscle spasms. They warned us about that in training. Sometimes the dead twitch. Sometimes they move, but not like that, not this deliberate. Still hunched, fighting the pain in my gut, I forced myself back toward the stretcher. I wasn't about to leave Harold just lying there. I had to get him into the fridge, shut the door, and get the hell out. "All right, old man," I said aloud, voice shaking. "You made your point. Let's finish this." I gripped both his arms again, colder now like they'd been dipped in ice water, and pressed them tight to his sides. Every hair on my body stood up as I shoved him into the drawer. It felt like resistance, like I was forcing him somewhere he didn't want to go. Finally, he slid in. I slammed the drawer shut and yanked the latch down hard enough to rattle my teeth. The second the latch clicked, the overhead light snapped back on. Bright, too bright. The hallway buzzed alive like nothing had ever happened. I backed away, half expecting the drawer to pop open again. It didn't. Everything stayed still. Without another glance, I grabbed the stretcher and practically ran it back to the service elevator, heart jackhammering the whole way. I didn't even fill out the report, didn't check the log. I just clocked out an hour early and sat in my car shivering until my hands stopped shaking enough to drive home. I told myself it was just nerves, just muscle contractions, just an unlucky angle that landed Harold's arm into my nuts. But I never went near the morgue again without another guard, and I never, ever looked a body in the face longer than I had to. Story 6, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, in a town where the roads curled like question marks around old coal shafts, and families stayed in the same house for three generations. I work in pathology now, but back when I was 13, my best friend Jason lived with his family in a funeral home. Not near one, in one. Their apartment was right above the viewing rooms and embalming area. The whole building smelled like lemon cleaner and wood polish, always cold no matter what time of year. Jason and I were inseparable. We'd spend our afternoons after school exploring places we weren't supposed to. Storage rooms, the flower prep area, even the cold chamber where they kept the bodies before embalming. We were stupid kids and thought we were invincible. We'd dare each other to touch the toe tags. I know how that sounds, but you spend enough time around death. You either get used to it or you break. There was this one Saturday, we were bored out of our minds and Jason's parents had gone out to pick up dinner. That left the two of us unsupervised in a place no two kids should ever be alone. "You want to play hide and seek?" he said, holding a flashlight under his chin like he was telling a ghost story. "In the casket showroom?" That was where they kept the display caskets, lined up like cars in a showroom, some open, some closed, some half-lidded so families could see the interiors. I hesitated. I didn't really want to climb into one, but Jason always had the upper hand, and I wasn't about to back out. We agreed on the rules. 2-minute countdown, you had to stay in the showroom, and if you made a noise, you lost. Jason counted first. I slid into one of the half-lid models near the back. It was lined in this itchy off-white fabric, and it smelled like plastic and carpet glue. I shut the lid partway and waited. You can't imagine the kind of silence in a place like that. It's thick. You hear your own heartbeat. You start noticing every creak and shift in the building. But I was used to that. What I wasn't used to was hearing a breath, not mine. At first, I thought it was Jason messing with me, but it didn't sound close. It sounded like it was coming from across the room, like a slow, uneven wheeze. Inhale, pause, exhale. The kind of sound an old man makes after climbing stairs. Then a shift, a creak, like wood under pressure. Another lid opening. I waited, holding my breath. The sound came again, creak, and then the unmistakable clunk of a lid being moved into place. I wanted to bolt up, but I kept telling myself it was Jason, that he was trying to scare me. I'd scare him back. But then I heard his voice. "Dude," he whispered behind me. "Where are you? I can't find you." He wasn't in the room. I could tell by the way his voice carried. He was still near the doorway, which meant whoever or whatever had opened a casket. It wasn't him. The breathing was closer now. I started to push the lid open. It wouldn't budge. I pushed harder, but it felt like something was sitting on it. I didn't yell. I don't know why. I think part of me thought if I stayed quiet, it'd go away. But it didn't. I heard something slide across the carpet, then tap on the lid above me, like a knuckle tapping once. Then again, tap. Then it dragged, a slow, scraping drag across the lid of the casket I was inside. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I could feel it above me. Then it spoke, not loudly, just a whisper. "Wrong one." I kicked the lid. Hard. It cracked open a few inches, just enough for me to wedge my fingers into the gap and shove it the rest of the way. I rolled out, hit the floor hard, scrambled to my feet, and the room was empty. No one. Every casket was closed. Jason came in a few seconds later, confused. "Dude, what happened? Why were you banging around?" I couldn't speak. I just pointed. He looked around annoyed. "You broke that lid, man. My dad's gonna be pissed." I told him what I heard. I expected him to laugh, to tell me I was full of it, but he didn't. He just got real quiet. Then he said something I still think about. "They brought in a transfer this morning from that place in Monroeville, but he was in a sealed body bag. Still is, I think." He checked his phone. His parents weren't due back for another 30 minutes. We went down to the prep room. I wish we hadn't. The body bag on the gurney was zipped up, but the zipper was wet. Like someone had been sucking on the metal. There were streaks on the inside of the vinyl. Long, greasy handprints, like something had tried to push out. Jason touched the bag gently, then jumped back. "It's cold, but not body cold, like it just got put back." We backed out of that room and didn't go back in. When his parents came home, we didn't say anything. What were we supposed to say? The next day, that transfer was gone. No service, no obituary, no paperwork. Just gone. Story 7. People always assume the scariest part of working around the dead is the bodies themselves. It's not. You get used to them. The silence, the smell, the weight. What you don't get used to is when something moves that shouldn't. Especially when you're alone. Especially at 3 a.m. My name's Ray. I live just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. And back in 2017, I was working nights for a small family-owned funeral home. Nothing fancy. We handled the pickups, prep, arrangements, sometimes even drove out for midnight calls when someone passed at home. It was mostly peaceful, quiet work. But there's one night I'll never forget, and I'm not interested in any theories or maybe you were tired comments. I know what I saw, what I felt, what I heard. That night I was on call. I remember I had just settled in for the night, hadn't even taken off my boots yet, when my phone buzzed. Elderly male, passed in his sleep, natural causes. I jotted down the address, grabbed my coat, and hit the road. It was maybe a 30-minute drive. The family was calm when I got there. Grieving, yes, but composed. I did the usual. Introduced myself, offered condolences, and gently explained the next steps. The man, Mr. Barlow, had prearranged everything years ago. It was all in order. I moved him respectfully to the stretcher, covered him, and loaded him into the van. By the time I pulled back into the funeral home, it was just after 3 a.m. The lot was dark and the place looked empty, as it should have. I parked in the back, unlocked the service entrance, and wheeled Mr. Barlow down the corridor. I wasn't rushing. I've never liked rushing with the dead. It feels disrespectful. The cooler is a walk-in unit at the back of the prep area. Steel door, reinforced, heavy as hell. It hums constantly, and when it clicks shut, it seals. I eased Mr. Barlow inside, checked the temp, logged the time, and stood there for a second. Don't ask me why, I just did. Maybe it was the quiet. Maybe it was habit. Then I felt it, like someone watching me. Not from inside the cooler, no, behind me. I turned quick. Nothing. Just the prep room. Sterile counters. Steel table. Embalming station. Dead quiet as usual. But something felt wrong. The air had that weight, like before a thunderstorm. It made the hairs on my neck stand straight up. I shook it off. Locked the cooler. I was moving toward the front, getting ready to set the alarm when, bang! The cooler door slammed. Not closed. Open, then slammed shut. Like someone had yanked it wide and shoved it back hard. I froze. My heart just stopped. That door doesn't swing like that. It's heavy. It doesn't move without force. And I know I shut it. I locked it. I turned slowly, almost not wanting to look. Nothing. No one. I took a shaky breath, walked back toward the cooler, and just stared at the door, still sealed. No one inside but Mr. Barlow. I didn't open it again. I couldn't. I backed up, slowly, not taking my eyes off that door. I hit the alarm and bolted out through the service entrance. I didn't even turn the lights off. I sat in my car, shaking, staring at the building. For the first time in years of doing this job, I didn't want to go back in. Not now. Maybe not ever. I didn't sleep when I got home. I didn't even change out of my uniform. I just sat in my living room with every light on and waited for the sun to come up. The next morning, when the day staff arrived, I came in early. I didn't tell anyone what happened. What was I supposed to say? That the dead man I brought in slammed the cooler door behind me? Later, when we prepped Mr. Barlow for his service, I kept an eye on him. He looked peaceful. Nothing strange. No marks. No weird expression. Just a quiet old man who passed in his sleep. But I swear, as we zipped the suit jacket over him, I caught a faint whiff of something. Not formaldehyde. Not disinfectant. Something else. Sulfur. That was the last time I ever did a solo drop at 3 a.m. No one ever believed me. My supervisor laughed it off and said it was probably air pressure or fatigue. But that door didn't move from pressure, and I wasn't tired enough to imagine the way that force came from behind me, the way the chill hit my spine right before it slammed. Whatever it was, it waited until I was alone, until the building was still, until the only living soul in there was me. I never forgot that night. Never will. Story 8. I'm a registered nurse at a small hospital in eastern Ohio, about an hour outside of Youngstown. Our ER isn't huge, just 6 beds and a trauma bay, but we see our share of chaos. Drug ODs, car crashes, the occasional stabbing. Nothing really rattles me anymore. I've cleaned brains off gurneys. I've watched people die with their eyes wide open. But what happened 2 years ago with that damn phone? Nothing's unsettled me like that. It was a slow Tuesday when they wheeled him in. Male, mid-40s, no ID. Found unresponsive in a hotel bathroom. Classic overdose. He was already gone by the time EMS got him to us. Pupils fixed. No heartbeat. Maybe dead an hour or so. He had a worn hoodie, jeans, and a cracked Android phone in his pocket. No wallet, no keys. Nothing else. We did the usual. Pronounced, tagged, bagged. No family showed. No one called asking for him. The cops came, took a statement, and left the body for transport to the morgue downstairs. But here's where it started. Someone put the guy's phone on the counter in Bay 3. Nobody thought about it after that. That room doesn't get used much unless we're full, and that week was slow. Next day, around 2:30 in the afternoon, I'm charting at the nurse's station. All of a sudden, I hear this loud, tinny ringtone coming from Bay 3. Not the phone ringing, an alarm going off. That harsh, default Android alarm tone, repeating over and over. I walk in, find the phone vibrating face down on the counter. The screen says, 2:30 p.m., wake up. I try to silence it. No luck. Lock screen needs a passcode. I try to shut it off, still won't. It asks for the PIN before powering down. I say, weird, and drop it back on the counter. Eventually, it shuts up. We all kind of laughed about it. But the next day, same thing. Exactly 2:30 p.m. That same harsh alarm. Now people are starting to get creeped out. One of the techs, Jamie, says, why don't you just smash the thing? But it didn't feel right. I don't know why. Maybe because it belonged to someone who died right there in our care. Maybe because it felt intentional. Day 3, same alarm, same time. The phone won't die. We never charged it. No one touched it. But every day at 2:30 p.m., it came alive. The screen lit up. The sound echoed down the hall. On day 4, I was in the med room when it went off. Even from behind a closed door, I heard it. That room's locked, by the way. Double code access. Someone had tossed the phone in there the night before to shut it up, but it didn't help. You're telling me this phone's been on for 4 days without charging? Our charge nurse asked. Battery must be shot by now, I said. But nope, still going. She rolled her eyes, but she was scared. We all were. On day 5, I stayed close to Bay 3, waiting. I wanted to see if maybe someone was pranking us. Maybe one of the night shift nurses was messing around. But no. 2:30 p.m. sharp, the alarm goes off. No warning, just beep, 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 over and over. I grabbed the phone, turned it over, and stared at the screen. Same message. 2:30 p.m., wake up. And then, I swear to God, it flashed. Not a light, not a screen glitch, just something, a flicker. The screen glitched black, then lit up again, but just for a second. And then the screen showed the camera view, like someone had turned it on from the inside, like it was filming me. I dropped it. Jamie heard it hit the ground and came running. I said nothing, just picked it up and walked it into the supply closet. I wrapped it in a towel, shoved it in a drawer, and slammed it shut. Day 6, 2:30 p.m. The drawer starts vibrating, loud, even louder than before. I open it. The phone screen is on, still wrapped in the towel, still flashing, wake up. That time I lost it. I walked the phone down to security, told them to do something with it, toss it, destroy it, bury it. I didn't care. They logged it as unclaimed property and moved it to the evidence locker next to the morgue. I didn't ask any more questions. Next day it was quiet. 2:30 came and went. No alarm, no vibration, just silence. But then, 2 hours later, Jamie paged me from the stairwell. "I think you need to see this," she said. "The stairwell connects the ER to the morgue level. No one uses it except for staff, usually just transporters moving bodies." I met her halfway down. She didn't say anything, just pointed. There, at the bottom of the steps, was the phone, just sitting on the tile floor. No cracks, no scratches. Screen still lit. 2:30 alarm message still visible. But it was 4:45 p.m. "I didn't touch it," she said, backing away. "It was just there." We both stared at it. Then I noticed something else. Wet footprints, leading away from it. Not bloody, not dirty, just wet. Like someone walked out of the cooler barefoot and left a trail. There was no one else on that floor. We checked every room. The morgue was locked. The cameras, offline, all of them. I quit a month later. Not because of the phone, officially, but I didn't want to wait for 2:30 again. Whatever was tied to that phone, it didn't want to be forgotten. And it sure as hell didn't want to stay dead. I've never told this story before. Not all of it. People would say I'm making it up. But I still check my phone every day at 2:30, just to make sure it's only mine that's ringing, just to make sure it's not coming from somewhere else, somewhere below. Story 9. I'm not religious, never have been, but that night in the ICU made me question everything I thought I understood about death. My name's Marcus. I live in Richmond, Virginia, and I've worked as a respiratory therapist for about 6 years now. Not the kind of job people dream about, but it's honest work. You get used to the rhythm of death in this line of work. When someone codes and doesn't come back, you feel it, but you move on. That night, though, I haven't been the same since. It was just after midnight, and I was on the 7th floor, night shift. We'd been keeping this older woman, late 70s, on a vent for 3 days. DNR was on file, do not resuscitate. She had sepsis, heart failure, the works. Her daughter and husband had already said their goodbyes earlier that evening. Everyone knew it was a matter of time. Around 12:40 a.m., her vitals dropped out completely. Flatline. The nurse confirmed it. The attending signed off. Her monitor showed nothing but a deadline. 5 of us were in that room. All of us watched her go. Now, protocol in these situations is straightforward. Once the physician confirms time of death, I remove the endotracheal tube and disconnect the vent circuit. Basic stuff. I've done it 100 times. I even joked to the nurse that this was the quietest night we'd had all week. She half smiled. We were all tired. So I went ahead and did my part. Pulled the ETT out first, then the OG tube. Gathered the used circuits in my hands. Turned my back to toss everything in the red biohazard bin behind me. And that's when it happened. This gasp, this inhuman, guttural gasp, ripped through the silence like something had been yanked back from the grave. Then came the breathing. Loud, wheezy, wet breathing. ragged, desperate, like someone drowning in air. I froze, my arms locked up mid-motion. I couldn't move, couldn't even turn around. I must have stood there for 3 seconds before someone screamed, one of the interns, and I finally spun back around. She was breathing, not just little reflexive spasms, not agonal gasps, breathing, full chest rise, rhythmic, intentional. Her eyes were closed, but her lips were twitching, and her face had color, pink, where it had been gray just a minute before. We all backed away from the bed. No one said a word. The attending, who was closest to her, just kept repeating, "What the hell? What the hell?" I remember staring at the monitor, still flatline. No heartbeat, no pulse ox, nothing. But she was alive, breathing like her lungs had never stopped. "Marcus, what's happening?" the nurse asked me, wide-eyed. I didn't know what to say. "She's not on the vent," I said. "She's not supposed to be. This doesn't happen." The room felt wrong. The air got heavy, like the walls were pressing in. My ears started ringing, and I could hear this faint buzzing, like a swarm of flies just out of sight. And then, her mouth moved. No sound at first, just a slow parting of her lips. Her teeth were clenched like she was trying to speak through them, the kind of grimace people make when they're choking back something. Then this voice, I swear to God, it came out of her like a cough, but it was clear. "Not done." Everyone backed up further. The intern dropped his clipboard. I remember it hitting the floor and sounding way louder than it should have. I felt sweat pouring down my back, and my hands went cold. I've been around dead bodies that moved, bodies that groaned, even gasped once or twice. It's just trapped air, muscle reflex. But this was different. She wasn't reacting. She was speaking. "No heartbeat," the attending muttered. "No cardiac activity, but she's breathing and talking." We were all frozen. No one wanted to touch her. The nurse whispered, "Should I page someone?" The attending didn't respond. He just stood there, eyes locked on the woman's chest, rising and falling steadily, as if she were in deep sleep. The monitor still read a dead flatline. Then her eyes opened. They didn't open slowly. They snapped open, like someone flipping a switch. Her pupils were blown, almost pitch black, and I swear they weren't looking at us. They were looking through us. "Too early," she said. Her voice didn't sound weak. It didn't sound like it came from a dying woman. It was deep, like it echoed through something much larger than that frail body. That's when the alarms went off. Monitors in the hall, down the corridor. Other rooms. Then the lights in our room flickered. All of us looked up like idiots, waiting for them to come back on. But they didn't flicker again. Just that one pulse. The attending finally snapped out of it. "Everyone out, now!" I didn't need to be told twice. I left everything on the counter. Tubes, gloves, mask. Just walked straight out with my heart pounding in my throat. One of the nurses was crying. Another was praying under her breath. We all gathered at the nurse's station, just staring at the patient's room. The door was still open. The lights inside looked dimmer than the hallway, like the whole room had dropped a few degrees in color. No one went back in. About 10 minutes later, the night supervisor showed up. They ran her vitals again. Nothing. No heartbeat. No breathing. No pulse. She was gone again. Dead. Like it never happened. They called it again at 1:06 a.m. Same patient, same room, same team. Second official time of death. I didn't go back in there to help bag the body. The attending told us not to talk about it. Said stress makes people see things, hallucinate, that sort of thing. But we all heard her. We heard what she said. "Not done." I called out sick the rest of the week. When I came back, her bed was already filled by another patient. I asked one of the aides if they'd had any issues in that room since. He looked at me for a second, then said, "You're not the first to ask. I haven't worked a night shift since." Story 10, I don't usually tell this story. I live in Elko, Nevada, tiny town, quiet, a lot of mining folks. I work nights at the county morgue. Been here 8 years. I prep bodies, handle the paperwork, sometimes assist with viewings if they're after hours. It's not glamorous, but it's steady. peaceful even. Most nights it's just me in the cold silence. But that one night, I still don't understand what I saw. This happened about 2 years ago, in October. I remember because we just switched the cooler fans to the winter setting. That night was dead quiet. No calls, no incoming bodies, and my coworker James had called in sick, so it was just me doing inventory and finishing up the last intake before locking up. The woman who came in that afternoon was a Jane Doe, early 50s estimated. No ID, no personal items, just clothes and a single key in her pocket. They found her collapsed in a public restroom near an old gas station off I-80. Natural causes, probably a stroke, but the autopsy hadn't been done yet. I waited until around 2 a.m. before starting prep. I wheeled her body from the cooler into the small wash station we have in the back. It's nothing fancy, a basic industrial faucet, drain floor, supplies all around. I turned the faucet on to fill a basin. The water came out cold as always, echoing in the room like it always does. I started unwrapping her sheet, then paused. I don't even know why. I just had this weird feeling, like I shouldn't be alone in there. I shook it off, positioned her under the faucet, and reached for the shampoo. That's when it happened. Clear as day, right behind me, I heard it. "Hey!" A woman's voice. Sharp, hoarse, urgent. Just one word. Not a groan, not air escaping. A full word. "Hey!" I froze. My hands were soaked, heart slamming. I turned around expecting maybe someone had walked in, maybe the janitor or someone from the sheriff's office. No one. Then I looked at her, and I swear to God, her mouth was open. Not slightly parted, open, wide, like she was trying to yell something. I took a step back and knocked over the shampoo bottle. I swear on my life I saw her lips twitch. Just a little. Enough that my stomach turned ice cold. "Nope," I whispered, and I backed out of the room. Fast.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
These days, I can do anything from my phone. Book a vacation, order a meal from a five-star restaurant, buy and trade stocks. But maybe the most amazing thing I can do is make my dirty laundry disappear and then reappear perfectly washed and folded. I have Rinse to thank for that. I just schedule a pickup in the Rinse app or at Rinse.com. A Rinse valet comes to get my clothes, and before I know it, they're back, crisply folded and ready to wear. They even do dry cleaning, which is returned hanging in a nice Rinse garment bag. And with Rinse, my satisfaction is guaranteed. If for any reason I'm not happy, they'll re-clean my clothes for free. Best of all, Rinse saves me tons of time each week. That's time I get to do something I love versus something I have to do. So if you want to save loads of time by not doing loads of laundry, remember, there's an app for that. Rinse. Sign up now and get $20 off your first order at Rinse.com. That's Rinse.com.
I stood in the hallway breathing hard, trying to make sense of it. I thought, maybe the body had some kind of residual nerve activity. Sometimes they twitch. Sometimes air escapes and it sounds like a moan. But a voice? A word? I waited 10 minutes before going back in. When I did, the faucet was still running. The water had spilled out of the basin and onto the floor. Her body was untouched, but her head, it was turned. It had been facing upward when I left. Now it was turned toward the door, toward me. That room is locked. No windows. No airflow strong enough to turn a 40-pound head and neck. I stood there, dripping wet from the mess on the floor, staring at her like she was about to sit up and tell me something. And the worst part, her mouth was closed again, tightly. I should have reported it, but I didn't. I couldn't. What do you even say? "Hey," the dead woman said, "hey," and moved her head while I stepped out to collect myself. I cleaned up in silence. I didn't finish the prep. I wheeled her back to the cooler, careful not to touch her more than I had to. But as I pushed her in, I kid you not, just as I was sliding the drawer shut, She made a noise, not a groan, not air, a click, like the sound your tongue makes when you press it against your teeth and pull it back sharply. Click. I slammed that drawer and backed away. I didn't go back into the cooler again until morning shift showed up. I said I wasn't feeling well and left early. She was gone a couple days later, transported to the city for further examination. I never heard any updates. No cause of death listed in the system. Still marked Jane Doe. They never ID'd her. I told James about it a month later, just to get it off my chest. He looked pale and asked me one question I wish he hadn't. Did she have that thing on her lip? I said, what thing? He said, like a scar. A split in the center of her upper lip, like it never healed right. I nodded. I remembered it. He swallowed and said, I saw her too. In the cooler. A couple days before you did. Her drawer slid open on its own while I was cleaning. Just a few inches. Like someone inside was trying to peek out. He never mentioned it again. Neither did I. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.